Conference is being recorded.
All right. Okay, everybody, all participants, please mute your phones. John, should we get started?
Yep, absolutely. I guess I didn't introduce myself. I'm John Campbell with Campbell's Along Resources, but I can tell you more, and I'll let you start with the question.
Okay. So let's first start with the most recent survey that your firm conducted. Well, in 2006, your firm conducted a survey in the Portland area of resident attitudes towards no smoking policies, and then a follow-up survey was conducted statewide in July 2008. Tell us a little bit more about the new survey and some of the interesting demographics that may be helpful to our work here in Colorado.
Okay, and let me probably give just a little bit of context for the survey and then a little bit about what the survey demographics, as you asked. Our first mission in doing the statewide survey was to find out if there was something dramatically different between the rest of the state of Oregon and our local metropolitan area. I imagine Portland's relationship to Oregon is not unlike Denver's relationship to Colorado, that people who don't live in Denver aren't always affectionate of being told that they are like people in Denver, for example. So we had done a survey work in the Portland area that said, hey, it looks like there's this type of demand for smoke-free housing, and the question was, yes, but is it different in the rest of the state? And so that was the sort of going-in question, and our mission was to ask essentially the same identical questions on the whole statewide, so that we could look at that information and measure whether or not the findings, tools, ideas, concepts that have been developed for the Portland metropolitan area were appropriate for statewide. And again, I assume there's some parallels for how things work in Colorado on that dimension at least. So when we did the statewide survey, we found things that were, as far as demographics, which was your question, which were not surprising to me from the standpoint of my background is both in market research and a high level of specialization in landlord-tenant issues. So in doing the research, what we found was what we expected to find when you talk to renters alone rather than simply general population or voters or some other subsegment, which is while Portland is a Oregon, rather, is not very diverse state. We certainly had greater diversity than we have in the general population. Very low incomes, which is not surprising with renters, and it's always shocking to me when I see how low some of the incomes are. You see a high turnover rate, which is also important to recognize that people who rent don't tend to stay in the same place as long on average, although there are certainly some renters who have stayed for quite a while. And I want to also emphasize the other sort of key demographic with this group, like the Portland Metropolitan Group, was that this survey is of renters. That is to say, it's designed to see what all renters think so that one can turn around and give feedback to landlords and property managers about the market to which they are offering their units. And what I just said was this is not simply a survey of people in multifamily property. So we were able to break down the information by people who are renting single-family homes, small plexes, and five-plus unit apartments, for example, because that tells us a bit about the market. And there are differences, of course, with those who are in single-family units versus five-plus. But that's just a little bit about the demographics. I can certainly talk about some of the smoking habits and some of that, Pete, but I'm going to let you moderate me through the questions or the direction that you want to go with that.
Yeah, I think some of the things that I found interesting were the age of the people who rent that they're very mobile. 2/3 are affected by secondhand smoke, and I think very importantly for us, because we always hear this, is that low-income and diverse populations are just as likely to suffer from exposure as people of higher incomes.
Yeah, and I would actually put that in a little bit different direction. I'm not sure that 2/3 are affected by secondhand smoke, but they're certainly, I'd have to look at they're certainly heavily bothered by it. That is to say, if they experience it, they are bothered by it. As far as the low-income people, I guess the challenge with landlords is that they tend to perceive, okay, fine, smoke-free is easy to offer for high-income rentals where people don't smoke much anyway, but, you know, those low-income renters, they all, for some reason, need to smoke, and it would be taking away their rights if they, you know, we'd be losing, you know, market share, and we'd have empty units if we said no smoking. And so the compelling thing, when, as we looked at the findings, both in the metro area of study originally and statewide, is yes, on the one hand, there is a somewhat higher propensity to smoke in the population, but as far as the more narrow question of what do you think about indoor smoking and do you want to live next to people who have indoor smoking and would you rather have a rent property where the landlord does not allow smoking, the difference is basically low-income populations are overwhelmingly in favor of smoke-free properties, no smoking rules, and keeping it outside, all those types of things. And there is, you know, if you can parse the difference between is 70% majority or 75% majority, but they're both really big numbers. So the answer is there's a very strong market for offering no smoking property, even at the low end of the market. And that was one of the strongest things to report to landlords is certainly are people in multifamily property more likely to be vulnerable to secondhand smoke? Absolutely. And the data show that that's the case. From the landlord's perspective, the fact that low-income folks are particularly interested in no-smoking property, that's the surprising piece of information for them that many are skeptical about and need to be convinced on.
Right. What were some of the key changes that you saw between, for your demographics and survey results for the Portland area between 2006 and 2008?
Oh, just within the Portland area and what had changed? I would primarily say that mostly simply within the Portland area, there were only small changes from 2006 to 2008. The data does indicate that it is likely that the percentages of landlords who that we had a measurable change in the number of landlords who were offering who I should say that differently the number of units that are covered by a lease or rental agreement where the landlord has set a no smoking rule, and it looked like that raised about 4 to 5 percentage points, but it was just on the margin of researchers. The industry standard is, say, 95% confidence level. This one was at 85. But it definitely looked like the trends that we had been seeing were starting to show up in the data, which, frankly, these kinds of global trends you don't expect to see show up too strongly too quickly. But we definitely saw a trend already starting to happen in Portland, and it's something frankly, in the trainings we do here in Portland, anecdotally, I will say that we train about 100 landlords at a time and do about 8 of these trainings a year. And particularly among the mom and pops, it is becoming almost the default to say no smoking in their rental properties, which is an interesting thing to see. So as far as the Portland survey itself, small changes in the number of landlords who are saying no smoking were measurable. I should say, again, the number of units that are covered by that. Comparing the Portland metropolitan area to the state, which is often interesting for those who work in rural areas versus urban areas, while there were some small differences, the great majority of the differences could be explained more reasonably by simply saying, what's the difference between this, in the rest of the state, people are a little bit more likely, skew a little bit more towards single-family housing. In the metropolitan area, we have a little bit more higher-density multifamily housing, and that difference describes the differences between the state much more than any other. And, you know, people are classically looking for, sort of blue state versus red state or liberal versus conservative, and some of those changes from differences between urban and rural areas, and we really flat out did not see those kinds of differences on the issue of smoking and attitudes towards smoking in renters in the state, period. And that was very interesting to see because our state certainly can get fractured on many other dimensions, but it is renters speak with one voice across the state on the issue of indoor smoking bans.
Great.
So, does that help?
Yeah, that's great.
Good.
So the next... I think really important question in terms of the research that you did in terms of with renters What are some of the key findings and conclusions of that research, and which ones are really important for messaging and for our work with landlords?
I think that this is the kind of question I'll try to keep brief, even though I think I could go on for quite some time. The key takeaways have to be read in the context of understanding what landlords are like and what they don't believe. And I know we'll talk a little bit more about the landlord research coming up, but a little bit of context is worthwhile, because what we were struck by in the landlord research is that those who have already gone to no smoking say, this is the best thing I've ever done, it's a no-brainer, my goodness, I'm making more money, it's easier to manage the property, it stays cleaner, my tenants love me, this is wonderful. Those who haven't gone to no smoking are very resistant to the idea, because they're having a greater problem with turnover rates, which is probably in part related to the fact that people are irritated by living next door to the smoke and some of that, but they're having difficulty keeping their units filled. And when we say, hey, you ought to go to no smoking rule, and they say, what, I've already got problems filling my units, and now I'm going to make more rules, and that'll turn more people away, oh my goodness, you're out of your mind. And so their attitude is almost, it's almost like they come from different cultures. And so the challenge in and the reason for this research was to do some truly objective market research that said, answer the question, is there actually a demand for smoke-free housing, or is this something that is just sort of, I don't know, some liberal desire of some health groups or some, you know, this is the kind of thing you can hear a libertarian landlord sort of saying, no way, I wouldn't do that, that's just some do-good or something. And the idea was to say, let's do real market research and say whether or not that there is a desire for this. So from that, some of the key things for landlords, you have to look at what are the barriers that are in landlords' minds to moving to this. And those barriers range on a couple of things. Certainly, key takeaways from this research in particular are the message, and I've talked to many landlords who were surprised and glad to hear this message, that you know what, even at the very low income, at the affordable housing range, public housing range, those types of things, that even people who smoke in general are more likely to prefer indoor smoking bans at their property. That low-income people in general are there's a greater market for non-smoking units than there is for smoking units, and you will be more successful if you do it. But letting them know that the market is there and some of those key numbers that come from that is an important element. And there are certainly a variety of other elements that aren't necessarily directly reflected in the research. I can't tell you the number of landlords who, when we tell them in a training that they can set a no-smoking rule, they're just thrilled to hear it, and they say, well, I didn't know I could do that. I thought it was illegal. And so once they simply understand that it's legal, understand that they can do it, understand that it's not discriminatory, but the key is understanding that there is a core, that they will actually be more successful, have a greater demand for their units if they go to a no-smoking rule. And that demand springs from both a higher portion of the rental market who will be attracted to their units, and lower turnover rates because you have higher tenant satisfaction. For example, if 4 out of 10 renters, and the number is about 4 out of 10 renters, say they would be uncomfortable even living in a rental unit where adjacent tenants are allowed to smoke. And that message is one that what that means is if you're allowing smoking, 4 out of 10 of your tenants are already irritated or looking for an opportunity to leave, and so that can be a challenge as well. But those kinds of key are some of the key findings with that. And I would say the one other sort of theme, and then I'll stop and take a breath and let you sort of guide me or ask me what else you want to contribute here. But another key takeaway here is that whenever you go to landlords, or frankly most folks, and say, I want to talk about smoke-free housing, or I want to talk about no smoking rules and those kinds of things, one of the filters that immediately pop in people's heads is, oh, you're talking about something that would be against all smokers, or I need to think, how many people smoke? So if one-third of tenants smoke, therefore that's going to turn away one-third of tenants and some of that. And the language needs to adjust to say that we're talking about indoor smoking rules, because the truth is these rules don't turn away smokers. They turn away that subset of people who have a strong desire to smoke inside their own homes. And in fact, most smokers today don't smoke inside their own homes anymore. And making sure that people understand that this is really something that would be inconvenient only to that very small subset of people who smoke inside their own homes makes it easier for landlords to understand it. And it's something landlords know intuitively, but they don't see it. When you ask landlords about this, they say, oh, no, you'll be turning away half my smokers or half my tenants or a third. When you say, okay, how many of your tenants smoke? They say, oh, I don't know, a third or so. You say, how many smoke inside? And they say, well, actually, most of them take it outside. And so they already know the statistic that it's really about 10% of the renters or so who are still needing to smoke inside. But for some reason, we don't see this right away. Does that make sense?
Sure. And just for all participants that are on the call here, after the call, when I sent out the information about the call, I did provide some links to all of the surveys that John's firm has done. But after the call, I will send out a copy of John's most recent renter survey. It's kind of long, but it's got some very interesting information. And one of the things that you pointed out in the survey that I found that I think we can use it. The fact is that, in Colorado we have this state law that we passed that requires all restaurants, bars, and most public places to be smoke-free. And I think you have something like that passed in Oregon as well recently.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so people are getting really used to, okay, my air is clean, but when I go to, but now my apartment's not clean. But also I think, as you mentioned, the research, a lot of the renters are highly mobile. They're less likely to stay in a smoky environment. But I think the other thing that you mentioned is that you believe that the demand for smoke-free housing will grow because people are getting used to living in a smoke-free society.
Absolutely it will. And it was funny that the challenge in writing that paragraph was the first time we wrote it, people thought, wait, are you saying that older folks want to live by smoke? It's like, no. What we're saying is that if you think about it, I'm 51, so I remember flying on airplanes when people were allowed to smoke, and it was sort of standard for people to smoke, even in classrooms in college and those kinds of things. So that seems to me like a somewhat normal context, although it doesn't happen anymore. But you have to remember that there is a huge number of people who are considerably younger than those of us who are older who have never been around any of that. And to them, smoking inside is something that is quite foreign. And just from my personal experience, I know when smoking bans started happening in restaurants, first I thought, well, that's curious. But I didn't really mind, frankly, sitting in a restaurant whether people were smoking or not. 20 years ago, the preceding statement was accurate. If I go into a restaurant or I go inside and someone's smoking now, I notice it so much more because it's so foreign. And we have to realize is that virtually all of our younger renters, those who are, say, under 35 or so, grew up in a world where there was very little smoking inside, period, from birth. And so that means it's not unlike if you survey a population on attitudes towards let's say gay marriage, you're going to have sort of 70-30 against among people who are over 65, but 70-30 in favor or more sympathetic to it people who are under 30, because norms have started to change on those ways, for example. And you see an interesting demographic bulge working that way with smoking as well, is the attitudes towards indoor smoking and the idea. The attitudes are plainly shifting from people have a right to smoke to people actually kind of have a greater right to have breathed clean air. But that's something that is moving up in the demographics. So it's unquestionable that the demand is growing and will grow. And landlords who do this first will be more successful than those who do it last, essentially.
Great. Well, before we go ahead and open it up for questions shortly, is there anything else that you can think of right off the bat that is important to consider when working with landlords related to renter surveys, to the renter survey?
I think that there's much more, and I guess I would generally say both reading the renter survey and reading the landlord's report would be beneficial just to sort of get that perspective of that. But I think we've covered a bit, and I expect that people may have some questions, so I should be respectful of time and allow those and cover some of those points and questions, I think.
We're right on time, so you did great.
Okay.
All right, everybody, you can go ahead. For those of you who have questions for John, go ahead and unmute your phones. And, again, once again, please introduce yourself and what county you're with. And let's keep these questions to the renter surveys for now, and then after the next segment, you can ask John more specific questions about his research with landlords. Does anybody have any questions?
John, this is Don Parsons. I live in the Colorado Mountains in a resort community where there's a huge unmet need for affordable housing, and so some of the municipalities in the county up here are beginning to get involved with private developers around employ workforce affordable housing, these kinds of projects. It's a great opportunity for us to institute policies up front in new properties. Do you have any experience with respect to that kind of congregate living in Oregon or through the survey?
So you're asking essentially, do I have experience with working with affordable housing and the sort of the dimension of how to deal with the smoking rules? Is that essentially the question, or the?
Yeah, that touches on it. Thanks.
Yes, experience, and then a response to that. I've been a consultant to HUD, and have worked with affordable housing providers and with public housing, which, if you really know housing, you know those are slightly different things. And work with helping them rewrite leases, set rules, and do those kinds of things. So I'm familiar with the dynamics inside of that population and inside of the landlords there. I will say that the key challenge in convincing folks who work with affordable housing to go to a rule like this is that they live in a world where they are so consumed by so overwhelmed, if you will, by the HUD regulations that they are complying with and making sure that they do everything correctly that, frankly, in my trainings to them, I'm often having to point out to them, hey, all these HUD regulations are minimums. You can do more. HUD is just saying you have to do at least these types of things, but they all get sort of focused on, I'm going to have this model lease that I got from HUD, pattern that, and I don't want to do anything extra, and they're all looking around making sure that they don't do something different, and they're a little concerned because there is, I can explain a little bit about how the criticalness in some states of making sure that no smoking rules are tied to a legitimate business purpose, because otherwise it would be seen as, could be interpreted as discrimination. So there are all these kinds of concerns that folks will have with that. And so the key message in affordable housing needs to be, first of all, absolutely, by law, yes, you can set this rule is a start. Second is reminding them, and every landlord knows that who's been doing this a lot, that smokers cost more money because the cleanup is a real, I mean, the horror stories that they told were incredible. So saying, okay, one, you can do this. Two, it's going to cost you a lot less to manage it that way. And three, and most importantly, you will run into this attitude that aren't you being discriminatory against low-income people because, don't you know that they have a need to smoke? And so that's where showing them this type of survey result and saying, look, this is what we know about low-income people, and they actually that's not the case at all, or even we did recently with the American Lung Association of Oregon helped them with a survey with a local housing authority where they surveyed their tenants and found essentially it was sort of uncanny how close it was to the exact same result. But that what was interesting to me was that housing authority needed to survey their tenants to find out if that was true. Because they were so nervous about making a change that was different from what they had done before. So I would say that it's probably easier when you're first building affordable housing to sit down and say, hey, here's a way to make your total cost of ownership less, make it easier to manage, and keep your tenants longer and more stabilized if you do this. So let's talk about doing this from the start. And, oh, by the way, your tenants will be healthier as well, which is not a bad thing. And but it kind of works. That's kind of the way the message structures. Does that help with that?
Are there any other questions?
Any others out there? Be happy
just
to
a reminder, if you put your phone on mute, it's star 7 to unmute. Star 6.
This is Lynette in El Paso County, and I just cannot get into the housing authority hierarchy. And even these things that you have just mentioned, these four things, are the approach that we have tried using and all of that. Have you encountered housing authorities that just all out said, yes, that's a problem, but we are not going to deal with it right now?
Certainly. Yeah, we have. And the I don't know whether you've got some of the training tools that we had put together. Frankly, here in Portland, there was a challenge with the Housing Authority of Portland about meeting with them, and frankly, they had just gone through a it can take more than a year to change lease agreements under public housing guidelines, and there's quite a review process that goes into that. And I had worked with our housing authority here, so obviously we had a pretty strong in there. And the American Lung Association said, well, can you help sort of facilitate a meeting with the housing authority? And so I called and we did get people to the table to talk about these issues. And what it really had to begin with is in our training tool, the sort of longer version, we talk about sitting down and saying, and you start by saying, what are some of the challenges that you see with smoking, and let them describe what they are, and kind of build that over time. But this is something that, well, I can't tell you how to, I suppose we could go offline and maybe have a conversation about what are the specific politics and issues, much more detail about what's going on with a specific housing authority they're talking about and kind of strategize a game plan for that. This is an issue that it's best understood that landlords are, there's sort of a landlord culture out there, if you will. And it is people looking around and saying, what do other folks do? And that's why one of the focuses by the Lung Association here in Oregon was to say, how do we get some of the biggest players to go smoke-free and then get good publicity around that? How do we keep working on getting more and more involved with this? I can only say generically, and I'd be happy to talk to you, you know, sort of separately and talk about what's happening with your specific housing authority. But rather than seeing that as the goal, I would say, how do we sit down with multiple different multifamily housing providers? How do we sit down with our landlording associations and talk with them about some of the benefits here? And I could certainly talk a bit about what not to say with these folks. You're going to go in, when you sit down with any landlord, they're going to first think, they have this whole set of filters that says someone from the government or from the health agency wants to talk to me. This either has nothing to do with my main purpose, which is to manage my property, or they're going to ask me to give some piece of paper to my tenants to explain to the tenants how to sue me. Because frankly, a lot of that happens. Whether it's over lead-based paint or it's over fair housing issues and other types of things. And so landlords, you know, you'll find key landlords who feel a little beat up when they're talking with folks that are talking to them about doing anything other than how to be successful in managing their property. So you have to sort of approach it and convince them that you really are coming at it from a different direction helping them understand that. Note that I said, and then I'll stop and let you follow up and tell me whether or not I've been helpful in this response, that when I said just starting with some of the initial questions that we often use with landlords, the initial questions have to do with what are some of the challenges with when you have tenants who smoke, what are some of the costs and those types of things associated with it. You're not asking them, hey, do you know how often you get tenants who are complaining to you about secondhand smoke? Because while that's a phone call that many of you get on a regular basis, honestly, it's not a phone call that landlords are getting with anywhere near that kind of frequency. Because usually when tenants have secondhand smoke problems, they're not automatically calling the landlord. They're closing the window. They're talking to their neighbors. They're looking at that saying, gee, or they're just deciding to move. But landlords will articulate very, very quickly. They know that smoking is a problem and they don't want it to happen because they know it's expensive and it's a fire hazard and those types of things. But notice when I describe what landlords see as a problem with smoking, very few are actually saying it's a health hazard from a lung standpoint. They're mainly looking at it from it's a really expensive thing and it's a fire hazard and some of that. So you have to play to that a little bit and then remind them that, oh, by the way, this is something that kills people from a lung standpoint as well. So was I helpful in my response, or would you like to follow up with clarification with that?
No, that's great. Thank you. I just want to ask one more question. Do you see anything ever happening from HUD encouraging their landlords to pursue this?
I guess, do I see something happening from HUD encouraging landlords to do this? I guess if I were to predict, I would say 10 years from now, I would say that yes, something will be in place from them. It wouldn't surprise me if 5 years from now, HUD might be, finally putting out a paper that lets landlords know lets housing authorities that are shy and frightened know that they're allowed to do this. But I don't see HUD as taking the lead on this, to put it charitably, because that's sort of not their nature with a lot of things. But that does go to the key housing authority culture problems. And I have to say, the housing authorities that I want to take and grab and just shake them by the lapels are those their problems are not simply that people are smoking and they're secondhand smoke. Their problems are some drugs that are doing very serious immediate damage, as in crack and a variety of different kinds of illegal drugs and people shooting each other over it and those kinds of things, and still they won't enforce rules that HUD has very plainly said. Not only are you allowed to enforce these rules, we'll even pull funding if we figure out that you're not enforcing these rules. So they've got some of them, and let me say very clearly that there are many housing authorities that do an outstanding job of managing their properties, but there are some I've worked with that have gotten this sort of odd culture where they don't want to do anything unless HUD says that you have to do it. And that's simply not what HUD regulations mean. It's not how they're interpreted, and that culture is something that there are many people, along with myself, who are working to change in housing authorities around the country. But that's been a probably 25-year process ever since actually Jack Kemp was the Secretary of Housing many years ago, and it lasted through both types of administrations, Democrat and Republican, trying to force this change. So it's a long history, but I would expect something from HUD, but not immediately. I wouldn't look for HUD for a lot of support with that. I would, however, look to your fair housing councils, or those who enforce fair housing in Colorado. If you can build some bridges there, that can calm down the nervousness among housing authorities. And some of that work has been done in Oregon. If you're having difficulty bridging that gap, I'd be happy to get references to people in Oregon who've kind of taken the lead there, because the fair housing folks have embraced this well, which causes housing authorities to feel more comfortable going ahead with it.
John, our question period is over now, so let's, for all participants, go ahead and please put your phones on mute for the next 15, 20 minutes, and we'll sounds like there aren't too many more questions about the actual research with renters, and it seems like more people are interested in the landlord pieces, which is brings us to the next segment. And I, without getting into real length, and again, people can, I do have a PowerPoint kind of summarizing some of the work that John did back in 2006. I'm sure he's learned a lot more since then. But we'll just, because there's so many people that are so new to this, I think it's a good idea for us to just talk a little bit about some of the research that's been done that John and his firm has done and that they've done in Oregon that I think is real helpful to all of us. So, John, let's talk a little bit about the research and focus group work that you've conducted with landlords and the housing industry in 2006 and beyond. Let's start by reviewing the key perspectives of those that have implemented no smoking policies as well as those that haven't.
Okay. Let me do that. And, Pete, I'm going to drive you crazy by going back to the renter thing for one point.
That's okay.
To sort of tie it forward. And I know I'm not following our format perfectly. I think the other key paradigm in communicating with landlords is that, that 8 out of 10 of their tenants already live in housing where the rule in that unit is that no smoking is allowed, because remember, tenants can set those rules themselves. And 9 out of 10 already live in housing where functionally it's smoke-free, simply because while they haven't set a rule, people aren't smoking inside. And so letting landlords, this isn't a question of only landlords can set the rule. Tenants can set the rule too, and the overwhelming majority of tenants do set that rule. And I think that's letting them know that their tenants are already well ahead of the curve, that they're setting the rule and they don't want to live next to other people who haven't set the rule is beneficial. And I often think if somebody mentioned they were in a, what sounded like a bit of a resort community. Here in Oregon, we've got resort communities where, frankly, every single resort is listed, every single dwelling is listed as no smoking. So we're marketing that to the upper market, and why not to those who are low income? So I thought it was worthwhile to make that point. But your question was sort of what did we learn from landlords, those who are enforcing no smoking rules and those who are not. Different points with that. One, I think as I described or referred to earlier, there is a dramatic difference in perspective of those who've gone to no smoking rules versus those who have not. But I think it's instructive to think about the experience that landlords who went to no smoking rules went through in order to get there, because it helps, it gives you hope for how to convert a property manager to doing this. Most landlords, there are a few landlords, I should say, that we interviewed who simply said, look, I hate smoking. I had a brother who died from lung cancer. I don't allow it, period. And they said the kind of motivation that a lung association would have for having a no smoking rule. So certainly a few said that, but the great majority who went to no smoking rules described it as an incremental process where they either described a last straw event, something that was, we cleaned up this place, that it took us, thousands of dollars, and we had to paint it many times and remove the carpets and everything, or we put in new carpets, and 6 months after the new carpets were in, when these folks moved out, it was so saturated with smoke, we had to tear the carpets out. But they just decided, I've had it, I'm not putting up with smokers anymore. Or they decided that they had just rehabbed a place and it was all nice, or it was a furnished place, and they said, it'd be great if we didn't allow smoking in this unit because it would keep it fresher longer. But for all of them, they sort of got to a point where they said, I'll try it with this unit or with this property. And then they essentially changed their ad to say no smoking, and they weren't sort of saying, I'm going to do this. And the landlords we interviewed all had large numbers of properties. I think the average about 300 units under management for the landlords. But it wasn't like they sort of one day woke up and said, I'm going to change all my properties to no smoking. It was more that one day they decided, I'm going to try this. I'm going to experiment. I'm going to say no smoking at this property or part of the property, those kinds of things. And once they tried the experiment, they realized, oh, my goodness, I've got more people applying for these units. And once those people move in, they tended to realize, oh, my goodness, they tend to, they all were uncomfortable describing it, but they said, if we rent to people who don't smoke inside, they tend to behave better. And they didn't know how to say that without it sounding like they were being sort of judgmental about people who smoke in a way that felt uncomfortable. But there was a sort of sense of people are staying longer, they're more responsible, and it's easier to rent my units. And it was like a domino effect that once they did that, they realized, over time, now I'm going to start doing this to my rest of my units because now I have learned that it works and I've viscerally experienced that. But for all of them, it was sort of putting the toe in the water first. And that's why often when I'm working with multifamily landlords, I won't try to sell them on, I don't need to sell them on make all your properties non-smoking. I want this, company-wide. you know, all if I can sell them on make this one unit, make this or make this one property, or I mean, depending on what type of landlord they are, or your single family homes, start there, do that with a few of them, and then they discover the success, and so it becomes naturally market driven. With the approach, but that's one of the sort of key findings, is that it was a sort of last straw event, and then they decided to go ahead and do that. And frankly, there were no landlords in the research, and no landlords are trained to ask the question where I've said, who here has gone to a no smoking rule, and you decided after a while, you know, it's just too much of a hassle, so I'm going to go back to allowing smoking. And I haven't found someone who's done that, period, which is very telling about how this is really a question of our assumptions about how the world works being different than how it actually works. And once we discover it's different, we tend to change. In sharp contrast, the landlords who are still allowing smoking, they really feel they tend to describe, first of all, that they have more vacancies, and compared to those who don't allow smoking, they're saying, I've got vacancies. If you tell me to set another rule and say no smoking, I'm going to lose even more tenants. And isn't that going to, you know, you can't tell me to do that because it's hard enough to rent my property, and now you're asking me to sort of set this, you know, I don't know, do-gooder health rule when all I'm trying to do is keep my rental units filled and earn some rent. And what they're not realizing is that the fact of allowing smoking is contributing to that environment where they have higher turnover and more vacancies. And particularly, that issue is going to get worse over time, because as more landlords offer no smoking, it means it's much like the what happened when restaurants divided between smoking and non-smoking. What it meant was, in the smoking areas, there was a lot more smoke because you concentrated it there. Well, you're going to start to see that in rental property as more and more landlords go no smoking. Those properties where smoking is allowed are going to become even harder for landlords to keep their units filled, because that's where you're going to have a number of those issues associated with that. But it was really struck us that landlords who allow smoking still were very skeptical of our data when we showed it to them. They just couldn't. They just had a very strong belief that if you tell tenants they can't smoke in their units, that they wouldn't have tenants to rent to. And it was with those folks that we realized that we had to get really specific. We couldn't say things like, you know, saying something like 9 out of 10 tenants feel this way, they go, oh, that sounds too Madison Avenue. But if we said 89% of tenants in your market area said the following, that got a little more specific. So we learned things about how to communicate with them that were that were critical with that. So those were some of the sort of most intractable issues with that. I will also say that the easier ones that were sort of no-brainers that we didn't research as much is there's certainly a number of landlords who simply don't know that it's legal to say no smoking, and once they're told that, they go, oh, I'll try that. And once they know that it's legal, or once they have simply a good example of a rule they can set, they immediately gravitate towards that. So those were some of the resistances. The other resistances or other issues were concerns about what about enforcing it and having it look too complicated. And frankly, one of the things we guided the Lung Association here in Oregon about is some of their initial literature looked like this was a really complicated thing to do. And with these sort of two-page non-smoking addendums and those kinds of things, that made it sound like a pretty elaborate thing. And the landlords who had gone to no smoking say, look, it's not that complicated. You just change your ad and say no smoking, you know, that kind of thing. You just write in the space on your standard lease form, you know, additional rules, you say no smoking inside the unit. But they were trying to describe it as a simpler thing than the very elaborate issues. But those are there's a sort of a tip of the iceberg there, but that's some of the findings there. But I'd certainly recommend reading the summary report on the landlords. I know it's actually not that long, and I read it yesterday and thought, you know, it's actually pretty interesting reading for those in that area. So,
I agree.
Yeah.
What did some of your research indicate in terms of how landlords actually enforce a no smoking rule? What are some things that they do?
It works this way. that, and if I may sort of introduce the talk about the issue of the no smoking rule versus a smoke-free rule, if you will, because it relates to what landlords can and can't do. Most landlords, first of all, said that when they say no smoking, generally it's not that hard to enforce, because, you know, unlike having to stand in front of a judge and explain how it is that you happen to know what marijuana smells like, you don't have to defend yourself with tobacco. Everybody knows what tobacco smoke smells like. So if you go into a unit and it has that smell, it's pretty hard to mask, and one can enforce it. But like most landlord rules, most rules that landlords set, it's half of enforcement is setting a tone so that you don't have the problem in the first place. For example, if I set a rule that says no pets, and you arrive to rent from me, and you can see pets, you can see that half the residents have pets, and I say, I fill out the rental agreement, and by the way, there's a no pets rule, you're going to feel pretty willing, allowed to break that rule. But if I let you know right away, fill out the application, I want you to know there are key things, no pets, or here's, you know, no dogs, or whatever your rule is. But if I enforce that, set a good, and let people know that I'm serious about that, there's a whole range that just goes to basic landlording 101. Do you set the proper tone? Do you communicate well with your tenants? Those types of things, so that you set a sort of cultural atmosphere where it is not permitted. But the main benefit with smoking, for example, you know, if I live next door to you and you get an illegal kitten and you move it in, I'm probably not going to report that to the landlord because I think the kitten's cute and I don't care. But if I rent from you and you've told me there's a no-smoking rule and you start to smoke next door, I'm probably going to call my landlord and say, hey, they're breaking the rule. And so it becomes relatively easy to enforce from that standpoint. The key here, though, is to recognize the promise that the landlord's making. I know Pete, you and I had talked about, should you say smoke-free property or no smoking property? One can certainly say, you know, we're trying to make the property smoke-free, or that our value is to have smoke-free property and those kinds of things. But in a lease, what we're talking about with landlords and what they're sensitive to is it should be a no smoking rule. Because if a landlord says this is smoke-free property, what they're doing is they can't guarantee that they can say I have a no pet property. They can say I have a no late payment policy. They can say I have a no crime policy. But they cannot guarantee to every tenant that the property is going to be free of crime, free of pets, free of late payments, or free of smoking. Because in every state, the way you would enforce a rule like no smoking is roughly the same way you'd enforce a rule that says don't let garbage build up or no pets, which is if your tenant starts breaking the rule, one serves some type of notice, and I can't quote you what the timing on the notice in Colorado is, but generally the notice is going to say, dear tenant, you've got to change this behavior within a given period of time, and if you don't, we'll terminate the lease, we'll kick you out of the property. But so if the tenant doesn't change the behavior, then I've got to go through, I don't just sort of show up and bodily throw my tenant out of the property, then I go through a court process, generally called an unlawful detainer process, that can take a month or two to actually remove a tenant. And so if a landlord were actually enforcing that, it is theoretically possible that someone could be in a unit smoking or having a pet or not paying rent or breaking any other rule or for some period of time during which the landlord didn't have direct power to immediately stop it. And for that reason, simply setting a rule that says no smoking and enforcing from there is an issue. But it is an issue for landlords who haven't gone to these policies. They're nervous that everybody's going to start smoking inside, and they think that it's going to become an enforcement expense for them, which technically it could become that. But what they'll find, again, is that unlike a no pets rule, this is a rule that most tenants will embrace, want to have happen, and will help with the enforcement of. And that's one of the key sort of support messages that needs to go with this. So does that help with that?
Yeah. I think, you know, a lot of things that we talk about also is, you know, to make sure you put a lot of things to recommend to landlords, that they put things in their lease, you know, that have, you know, spell out, you know, what happens if you violate the policy, you know. So, and some people have actually also put, you know, really have something like, okay, if we find you smoked there, you could be fined, and you'll have to pay for the cost of cleaning it up.
Mm-hmm.
Warning letters, fines, putting up signs, et cetera. And then, I think you mentioned in a couple of your reports the importance of letting people know, advertising, that it is a non-smoking building.
Absolutely. And I think it's both setting it up at the front end so that people come in with that expectation, so it's easier for them to follow through. Something that I think, and I think certainly letting people know that you're going to be, if you are smoking, the first violation is a fine of, I don't want to be too cavalier here because every state has a little bit different rules. I would guess Colorado, being a western state and where it's located, a landlord could likely set a rule that says, the first time I discover you've been smoking, it's a $100 fine. The next time I'm going to terminate your lease, that kind of thing. So they can set those types of rules. But I just cannot emphasize enough, and this is what I've constantly spent time with landlords, is they get all upset. They say, well, I set all these rules and tenants don't follow them. And I say, well, you need to turn to the people that enforce the rules. Well, who's that? Well, that's you. You've got to do that. And actually enforcement of the rule is something that landlords often don't do as well. A lot of what I try to work with landlords is let's set the tone, let's do this, and then teach them the basics for enforcing the rule. I do want to add, though, that I have seen some, page and a half non-smoking addendums that I think are not helpful to the cause, if you will, because they make it look very complicated. And enforcement of a no-smoking rule is really the same as enforcement of any other rule in a lease. And the non-smoking addendums I have seen really spring from someone has said it's a smoke-free property, so now this addendum has all these paragraphs about how the landlord can't warrant that it's going to be smoke-free because of one thing or another, but they do warrant that they'll take reasonable steps. And it looks like it's which is, frankly, all the same warranty the landlord is giving on all the other rules as well. So I tend to shy away from some of that and say, let's keep it simple. Let's say the rule is no smoking, that there are penalties to your security deposit, that you will pay for any damages done in the cleaning. Those kinds of things are very standard. And I would say keep it standard, keep it in the context of what landlords and property managers are used to, rather than treating it as a very new thing. So does that make sense?
Yeah, great. So the next question, I think you've already mentioned some of this earlier, but in case you missed something, based on your research and your experience since then, what are the most salient messages to use with landlords and people in the housing industry? I think you've already mentioned, some of them earlier, set the rule, costs, economics, it doesn't affect low income, anything else?
Yeah, I would say that those are some. I think I have covered some of those, and I think we've pointed out some of those in our reports. I might be a bit redundant, but essentially, that there really is a market for them. That the world has changed since 1965, and that most people are expecting that. That it's legal to do. That there's simple language. That there's help for doing this, and that they will make money by doing it are some of the key elements. I personally am most fascinated by showing them that sort of cultural shift because I think that gets them thinking differently, like explaining and I think it's a good analogy to say there are so many states that have gone to the no smoking in bars or no smoking in restaurants and some of those issues. And recently in Oregon, when this was debated at the legislature, then the law just went into effect this last January 1st for no smoking in bars and restaurants, period, that initially, I think there was a musician. I'm going to get this sort of. This is not something we researched directly. So if you want to quote it, let me know and I can get you the actual articles that give you the correct facts on this. But there was a union of musicians that was fighting that law at the legislature, saying this is don't do this. This is going to harm our income and those kinds of things. And then they talked to their counterparts in California and in the state of New York, who said, wait a minute, no, you don't want to fight this law. You want to support it. Because actually, who knew? It turns out that there are a lot of people who like music who don't like to be around smoke. And once you pass the law, you're going to have more people coming to hear your music. And the interesting thing was, and so they flipped around and started supporting it. But the interesting thing was is that they started with the assumption that once you say no smoking, you'll lose customers. And restaurants and bars do that as well. And I often just point out, you know, that Ireland doesn't allow smoking in bars. And if Ireland can do it and the bars didn't close, something extraordinary is happening. And it's that cultural change that I think is important as well with the landlords. So all of those messages matter, and I would say, but it also matters who's delivering the message and how you deliver that. But we can talk about that, Pete, if you'd like. But that's a little bit about what some of the messages are.
Yeah, and that's the next segment here. It's been great here. So what are the best ways to communicate messages, and maybe also let's talk a little bit about also what are the vehicles of delivering those messages as well. There's one thing to know what the best way to communicate in, but you also how do you get those messages out?
Mm-hmm.
I think it's just as important. What are some of the effective tools?
Yeah, let me draw an analogy with the trainings that I do when I'm teaching landlords about dealing with illegal activity. There's a section where I spend quite a bit of time talking about the importance of building good, strong resident relations and treating residents well and all those kinds of things. And during that section of the training, all I'm doing is the primary motivator I'm talking to landlords about is about that if they do this, they'll make more money. And the reason I push on that motivator is because I know that landlords are really thinking, oh, this is the do-gooder message, and they start to turn off their listening because they figure, oh, yeah, a government agency, because I do this generally sponsored by government agencies, would tell us to, you know, be nice to our residents. So the only way I can make that message stick with them is to really emphasize the other part of it. And that analogy works from this standpoint, that the landlords are going to be, first of all, they'll give more credibility to any message they hear from someone who's in the industry. And they will give less credibility to people that are not in the landlord property management industry. If I am a well-known property manager and I say to the landlords, hey, here's a new rule we went to and it's great for the health of the tenants, and I even open with that, landlords will keep listening to me because they know I've got, you know, 3,000 units and I've been there. But if I'm a lung association or a health department and I say to the landlords, hey, we've got this great rule and it'd be great for the health of the tenants, I cannot tell you how fast they're going to turn off their listening, because their response is going to be, our job isn't to be their nannies or be their parents. In fact, we shouldn't be treating them that way, because that's, you know, sort of treating, you know, and they're going to raise all these different issues that come up in the landlord-tenant world, as because there can be a fair amount of acrimony there. So when particularly the messages that come from the health organizations need to be messaging that that has the underlying subtext, landlords, we understand the challenges that you're up against, and we're offering something here that, yes, will benefit people's health and will also benefit your bottom line in an interesting way. And we went out and did the research that most landlords couldn't afford to do to show you that that's actually the case. And so you're very being very respectfully approaching that business message. And frankly, I thought one of the most important things in the effort done in the Portland metropolitan area was the amount of outreach that was done to include the local property management associations and find key folks there. And it takes a little time, saying, I want to talk to different managers. Can I come to some of your meetings? And I want to find people who have no smoking rules and see if they'll help with this or endorse this program or help us shape it and some of that. But when landlords and property managers start seeing literature or messaging that indicates that this is endorsed and signed off by the local advocates for landlords, they tend to give it more credibility. So those partnerships, I think, definitely help. And I would say one other thing that I think is actually the sort of subversive thing that is going to cause, in my view, the most significant change in Oregon most rapidly is simply in Oregon, and this varies by state, but in Oregon, most landlords and property managers purchase their rental forms from one of three providers that provide state-tailored rental forms. And going to those three providers and working with them so that they would either provide a non-smoking addendum or a checkbox for is it smoking or non-smoking on the rental agreement. Because landlords get these rental agreements, and basically about the sum total of their legal education sometimes is they read the rental agreement and go, oh, I guess I'm allowed to do that. And just having smoking as an option or not is, I think, going to change the paradigm significantly. So I think it really does matter who gives the message, or another way to put it is the type of message changes depending on who you are. The worst message you could give as a health department is go sit down with landlords and say, we're here to advocate for your tenants' health, and we want to, and we're here to teach your tenants how to sue you if you don't implement these rules. They're not going to warm to that too well. If you follow that sort of difference in continuum. So, is that helpful?
Yeah. Are things like, and Norgan's done some great stuff in terms of educating landlords, you know, like the landlord how-to booklets, and I've seen some of the ones done in other states, and by far the one that Oregon has produced is probably, in my opinion, the best one, because it goes right to the messages that came out of your research and in the order that they should be delivered, I think. So
yeah.
Are those kinds of things, direct mail, websites, all that, are they having results? And maybe you don't know the answer to that question, but no.
I think that I do think they are having results. I can just offer some general comments on that. I have the Oregon Landlord's Guide to No Smoking Policies in front of me here because I want to make sure I had it around while we were talking about these things. I think they did do a good job of having that information compiled there. I have to say, with all the work we've done in market research over the years, yes, it's important to get that messaging down and having that available in a clean, simple way on websites, having it available, and I don't know whether you need to do it. You know, these brochures can get expensive as we look at tabs and all those kinds of things.
Right.
But having enough information so that people have these issues. But it's very often I see a lot of money goes into developing a brochure and not so much going into saying, how do we get this out to people? And if I were going to say, gee, if your budget is really, really tight, I'd say I'd say focus on saying, what's our strategy to reach multifamily property owners? How do we get lists of them? Can I get an intern who can develop lists and develop we'll have a mailing campaign, and we'll have something a lot lighter that costs us less to mail out, that has some key things, drives people to a website those kinds of things, so that that's the idea is make sure that you have a plan for how you're going to make sure this gets in the hands of a lot of people. And then you're going to look at what are the trade association meetings, because the most landlords don't go to any trainings, but the key opinion leaders do. And so let's go to those associations. They're always looking for free speakers who will come and talk about what they're doing. And so getting a kiosk there where you can show the information and hand out the brochures and have people talk knowledgeably about it can start to influence, so that you are routinely there right next to the people who are selling the coin-op dishwashers and all the other stuff that gets marketed to landlords. But have a plan for how you're going to disseminate it. And certainly if you could do a brochure with the tabs and all that, like the one done in Oregon. I know Maine did one, I think, was, if I'm recalling accurately, was pretty impressive as well. Certainly that's a great thing, but what I would hate to see happen is a lot of effort put into putting that together and then having mainly it be filling a bunch of boxes in a back closet in someone's office somewhere.
Exactly.
Because getting the message out and having a good strategy for making sure that happens is what I think matters most.
Yeah, and I think, both Oregon, Maine, and some of the other states, one of their strategies is also just to, either get booths, buy a booth so that they can go to these conferences and develop those relationships and get that, information out. That's paid off. We have about 5 minutes left, so I have one other question, then we'll open it up for calls. And you and I talked a little bit about this. I think you were a little bit surprised. But, one of the challenges that we found is that even with, and I think it's just because this is so new in Colorado, that even with landlords and housing, people in the housing industry that have already adopted no smoking policies, we've struggled sometimes with even getting in the door with those people. We found that some of the local health departments will call them and, and try to say, hey, why don't you get involved, or can we talk to you, can we sit down with you, can we get a testimonial from you, and just, you know, found some struggles in terms of even getting in the door with people that have done this.
Mm-hmm.
So do you have any suggestions for people? How do you get in the door more easily, even with people who have done this and probably are? And I said, some of it's because it's so new and they're maybe afraid to, you know, stick their foot out. But you have any thoughts on that?
As you and I talked about, I was a little surprised to hear that people who'd even gone to these policies seemed sometimes reluctant to talk. But I guess my main advice on that type of situation would be so that some of you know the context. I've been working with landlord-tenant issues for more than 20 years now, and I first got into landlord-tenant issues. I've trained in 30 states and on these issues, and I first got into these issues because, frankly, I was pretty darn angry at landlords for allowing so many drugs and crimes and gang problems in so many housing that was tearing apart neighborhoods. And that was where my direction in. And I began with my attitude was, I can't stand these people. You know, the landlords are driving me crazy. How do I get them to change? But I knew if I wanted to train them and show them how to voluntarily do things profoundly differently rather than simply come up with a new law that made them, the new laws only have so many, can only do so much. And I wanted to say, how do we change the culture here? What I realized is I had to do an awful lot of listening. And I had to put a lot of issues aside. And so I think if you've got people who are reluctant to be quoted and those kinds of things, I'm going to just step back and say, how do I do a more gentler approach? Say, look, what I'm looking for is, I know you're really busy. I just want to buy you a cup of coffee, and have you give me advice about what you think ought to, how to encourage other landlords to do this, or what some of your key learning was. And do a lot of listening with that. I generally know from my organizing experience, if I call people up and say, hey, I want you to get involved, they kind of find anything to do other than that. But if I go listen and sort of build those connections and just allow it to grow over time but be persistent with it, that often I can be more successful. But it's sort of an organizing 101 challenge, which is that lots of contacts, continuing sort of nurturing it along and letting them help shape the agenda. Can cause them to be involved, but I don't have anything other than that sort of a general organizing recommendation, which is another area that we do some teaching on.
Yeah.
But
I think one thing that I found, you've got to listen and you got to come in there, almost pretending that you don't work for a health agency. You know that you're there to listen to where they're coming from first.
Yeah,
that's great. Now, and then you start talking niche, or you start talking, well, can you save money? And you start asking them some leading questions, and maybe that gets you in the door.
Yeah.
But I think you're right.
If I may just jump in with one thing. The savvier landlords, when you call them or want to talk with them, they are going to have a key fear in their head, which is, aren't you guys really about passing a new law to force us to be the regulators of one more social good issue? So when you're sitting down with them and emphasizing, no, this is about a voluntary process, this is about showing landlords there's an actual benefit to them, but if you sit down and say, we're both working with the legislature to create a new law to force you to do this, and we want to talk about how to voluntarily do this, there you're going to get some. The savvier ones who are, you know, part of that those lobbying efforts are going to back up hard and close the door hard on you. So watch those messages as well, because landlords get pretty sensitive to that. That can be something that can cause the door to close pretty quickly. So,
great. Okay, so let's go ahead and open up the line for questions. And once again, just a refresher, push *7 if you've muted your phone. And again, state your name, what agency you're with, and we have about 15 minutes for questions.
Hi, this is Susan Sipkowiak from the Jefferson County Department of Health, and I really want to thank you for your information. This has been really helpful. One question that I had when you were talking about, and I fully understand that, is to not for landlords not to say they have a smoke-free property, to not guarantee something that that could be open to litigation or whatever if someone is, in fact, smoking. So what's a more positive way of promoting that, especially like for advertising or something, you know, rather than saying, well, we have a no-smoking rule? I mean, is there a more positive kind of way to put that where it still is not going to run into some kind of legal issues where you're guaranteeing something?
Yeah, I understand what you're asking, and I guess saying, I guess when I look at, I think of there's a place in the middle of Oregon over by in the Cascades that we often go rent, and they're always advertising simply non-smoking, it's, you know, landlords, if you're going to, when I've advised landlords on these kinds of things, and my first exposure to it was on safety issues, you never say, I guarantee this is safe property, or I guarantee that we're doing everything that a landlord could do to keep it safe, because there's always something you haven't done, and if something bad happens, you could be sued, or those kinds of things. You never say it's crime-free, even though I know there are programs actually modeled on programs we created where people use those phrasings, and it's not the best way to go. But I think saying non-smoking property, saying we are committed to having cleaner air, those types of things I think are certainly appropriate. A landlord can certainly say we are working to have this property be as smoke-free as possible, or we are working towards smoke-free property, that kind of thing. But a little bit of room to represent it as in progress. But a guarantee, if your communication is guaranteeing that it's smoke-free, you will certainly have some landlords just wanting to lecture you on how that's impossible and unfair and those kinds of things, and raising issues that you don't really need to, you don't really want to be wading into. So I know non-smoking is a bit more of a mouthful, but can be a little bit safer with that. But and I'm not saying you shouldn't say the word smoke-free. Just be careful that a landlord shouldn't be saying, shouldn't be representing that. They can say we're committed to smoke-free property, or we're working towards smoke-free property. We are adopting smoke-free policies, and then say we have a no-smoking rule and those kinds of things. But does that help? I know that's. I feel like that was a little wiggle-ish in my answer. But,
I think a lot, yeah. And John, I think a lot of it too is that most of the properties that we have listed on our website that list those smoke-free multi-unit properties in Colorado, most of them only limit don't allow smoking inside.
Uh-huh.
I think maybe 15% to 17% of and we're almost up to 300 now, actually also have a no-smoking policy for the entire property.
Yeah.
So it's easier for the ones that are totally smoke-free for their entire property and inside to say that they are smoke-free than the ones that, because if you have one that has it inside and they don't have it outside, the smoke can drift inside. So it's then it's not smoke-free. But
I suppose you can say smoke-free property rule or that type of thing. But I think also, Pete, you raised or touched on an important point, that is we saw high consensus with landlords, that those who went to no smoking, that having an indoor smoking ban and something that says the smoking needs to be, you know, X number of feet away from the building, and some were 10, 15, 20, 25, but having an indoor smoking ban was something that there's high consensus, this works, and there's a strong financial motivator for doing that. We saw low consensus on property-wide ban, and for that reason, our recommendation in the initial research was focus on, you know, it's sort of like the original abolitionists were just trying to abolish the slave trade, even though they really wanted to get rid of slavery entirely, but they figured they had to do one thing to stop the next. Focus on mainly promoting, do let landlords know you can actually do it's perfectly legal to do a property-wide ban, but don't make that the primary thing you're trying to cause them to do. Try to cause them to create those indoor smoking bans and no smoking within X number of feet of the building, knowing that as that becomes popular, I would predict that you'll see 5-10 years down the road, people starting to the idea of smoke-free property, period, becoming a more popular thing. But I think I think it's pushing something that isn't supported by the market demand or landlords to be pushing. If you step in and say, we want everybody to go to smoke-free property, people say you're crazy. If you say, we want to talk about no indoor smoking and keeping it away from the building, and here's how people are making money doing this, you'll get better traction. Does that make sense?
Yeah, great. Let's go ahead. Anybody else have any more questions? We have about 10 more minutes.
Yeah, hi, this is Nick Metchikoff with the American Lung Association here in Colorado. And you had said earlier that there were assumptions about people or about landlords as to, you know, people were leaving because they couldn't smoke now and things like that. Do you know if anybody has ever, or do you even think it's a good idea to do, for lack of a better way of saying it, some sort of exit interview with their tenants to see why they are moving? Is that a standard industry thing, or does no one do it? What do you think about that?
There are certainly, I mean, landlords do that somewhat informally when someone says they're planning to leave, but I would not expect, I probably wouldn't recommend that as a tool to sort of document, look how many people are leaving because of smoking issues, unless, I suppose, just thinking out loud, including that on a list of questions that might be, you know, did this influence the issue as well? But I think you're going to get fairly muddied results even if you did that, simply because when, first of all, there's a power relationship between landlords and tenants where that tenant's leaving and what they want is a good recommendation from the landlord when they leave, and they're also someone who may not have let the landlord know that they moved their best friend in who was perfectly well behaved, but it did break the rules. And you know, there are different kinds of tensions that are there. And so the likelihood of them, of getting a lot of people whose pure and single reason for leaving was someone was smoking next door. I would imagine that their reasons for leaving will be a combination of, hey, I had a friend who had a better place, and I jumped at the opportunity rather than not jump at it. And the reason I jumped at it was, you know, both that sounded nicer, and also there's a bunch of irritating things that have been happening at this property, some of which are associated with, you know, smoking, but it's actually not that many people who are going to be leaving only for that reason, although those people are the ones who call you guys up. But generally, landlord-tenant relationships are more complicated than that because there's all different kinds of factors that go into, you know, it's just those really irritating people next door who are, well, I can't stand it, their cigarette smoke, and by the way, what they're also doing is cooking meth or doing something else is extraordinary, some of that. So I'm not expecting that to be something that you could document that well. I definitely think you could document that those measure vacancy rates for those who allow smoking versus those who don't allow smoking. I think that would be very interesting to do, and I think that would be very revealing.
Yeah, I think the other thing in your that was really interesting in your recent renter survey, too, is that, and your previous one, too, is, and the question that was on there is that a good percentage of these people would be willing to pay more to live in a non-smoking building, and that included people of lower income.
Yes. Yeah, and I want to emphasize with that question, these are a series of questions that were about measuring, getting really close to demand issues. And, for example, when we said, do you agree or disagree with, I think we said, even small amounts, daily exposure to even small amounts of secondhand smoke are a health risk. We asked that question in that phrasing so a skeptical person who thinks secondhand smoke is no big deal could read it and go, my goodness, and I forgot the exact percentage, but 7 out of 10 are saying that that even phrased that way, it's still a serious issue. And so we could get that kind of resonance with it. And when we asked, and it's classic in market research, you know, you say, all things being equal, would you select this? And you'll get a reasonable number of people, if it's a desirable thing, saying, oh, yeah, I'd select that. So we had, you know, numbers in the range of 7 out of 10 saying, yes, I'd select that, all things being equal. But then following up and saying, would you be willing to pay a little bit extra for it? And again, I'd have to look up our numbers. I don't have it immediately for me. I want to say about 4 in 10. Pete, does that sound right? Said that?
Yeah.
About 4 in 10 say they would actually pay extra for it. And that's sort of the sort of solid test question of, you mean you'd go out of your way And when we first asked that question, we had a number of, or designed it, I frankly had some people say, oh, this is a social justice issue. You shouldn't ask if they would pay more. Don't you understand that we're not here to raise anyone's rent and those kinds of things? I said, no. This is, I mean, I would ask it, would you be willing to travel an extra mile, you know, go, you know, and list a number of different inconveniences and say, accept one of these things, but it gets a complicated way to say it. That all this tells us is that this is so important people would inconvenience themselves. And the truth is market forces will determine whether or not landlords charge more. And in fact, if you look at the cost-benefit ratio with no smoking rules, landlords save money by offering no smoking. So if anyone's going to charge more, I could see a landlord, you know, in theory saying, if you agree to a no-smoking rule, you know, the rent's $50 less a month. If you agree, if you insist on smoking inside, I'm going to charge you $50 more. I'm obviously not recommending landlords do that, but the market forces are that for any landlord who charged more for no-smoking, there were going to be 10 landlords who charged less for it, and so that landlord couldn't compete well by doing that. So, but the main issue is that, yeah, tenants are saying, we feel so strongly about this, you know, we'd even inconvenience ourselves to get it. And that's an eye-opener, because there's only 1 in 10 who feel strongly enough about indoor smoking that they still do it. But you've got 4 in 10 who feel strongly enough that they'll pay extra to avoid it. And that's an interesting thing.
We have 5 more minutes for questions. Any other questions?
Hi, Pete, I think we stunned them. I'm not sure.
Okay, and some people may have left already.
Yeah. No, you've been very thorough and thought-provoking. It's a very good. Thank you.
Oh, good.
And some of the things that you're talking about, I mean, this is Jill at the State, and yeah, I had a landlord call just last week and very skeptical about health claims and really thinks we ought to be putting our energy into better filtration systems.
Mm-hmm.
And So, and yeah, don't see us as credible resources in terms of the health claims information. So
yeah.
That's a hard one for us to. How do we get past that? How do we?
Yeah, and it may be for that landlord. It sounds funny, but even thinking, okay, I don't really need to. I don't need to sell this person on the health claim.
Yeah,
I need to sell them on. Here's what your tenants think about the health claim.
Mm-hmm.
And here's what your market is. And so, look, even filtration or not, I'm here to tell you, you can be more successful. You can make more money, and your tenants will be happier. So even if the health claims weren't true, you know, it's going to be worthwhile. It's funny. You have to work on that communication and how you do it. But you can see how we've kind of got ourselves boxed in this paradigm generally around the country that says if we're trying to get landlords to do something, it's probably not for their own good. And so they get pretty skeptical, and they get kind of angry about it. So we have to when we worked on the project, I thought, well, this is the easiest thing in the world because this is something that this is an idea whose time has come. This is something that, and frankly, I see it more West Coast as I train around the country. You know, now when I'm training on the West Coast, I see half the landlords say, yeah, we have a no smoking rule. East Coast, you know, I see a lot less of it. And I would expect that Colorado to be a little bit more towards the. I would expect you'd have a fair number of landlords, particularly the mom and pop, starting to go to no smoking rules already pretty strongly. So, it's coming, and it's a question of how do we accelerate it. And that's what makes this one nice.
Well, and we're about to launch a TV spot directed at parents about exposure of secondhand smoke in their home. But one of the things, the message that we are promoting is that it goes under doors through vents, you know, the secondhand smoke travels and lingers in the space. And I'm thinking it may prompt some tenants to be, to increase their concern or awareness.
Yeah.
And in fact, I've been telling our local health agencies, be aware that, you know, become familiar with this campaign because you may get more calls. Is that, do you think that that is likely? Are we, as we talk to parents, will other tenants listen?
I think that other tenants will listen. And it wouldn't surprise me if you started to get calls from tenants. And one of the key elements in doing that is when you get the calls from tenants, if you immediately go into coaching the tenant on sort of how to sue the landlord or talk with the landlord, you say, oh, you're getting this, you're getting these problems with the property, and you have some options. You can talk with the landlord. Here's some materials that you could share with the landlord. You can certainly choose to move if you wanted to do that. But if that's an opportunity to talk with the landlord and show them how they can do this stuff, that would be beneficial. And if that statewide campaign, the TV spots, are talking about those issues and hopefully being silent on landlord-tenant issues, but still having it be something that teaches tenants, I think that's great. If it doesn't sound like it does, but if it had a spot saying, and if you're a tenant, talk to your landlord about it, you're going to have landlords lining up.
We intentionally didn't do that.
I think that sounds. I think that sounds good support for it.
And one of the other things you might look at, Jill, is to talk to the people in California and see what, since they put together they've done a TV spot on. It was more centered around multi-unit apartments, but it had the kind of very similar messaging in terms of showing how smoke invades different parts of a multi-unit apartment, just to find out what kind of response they've gotten, whether that's generated a lot more calls. But I think John will probably agree with me, is that, having worked now with tenants or residents for the last couple of years, that a lot of them just don't want to rock the boat. They're afraid. They're going to be kicked out. Some of them just don't have the skills to do it. So I really think where we need to go and where we need to focus more of our energy is to work with landlords, with people in the housing industry. And I think we're going to get a larger, because working one-on-one with a tenant with one building might result in one building going smoke-free, but I think if we start working with the landlords, we're going to see a much bigger chunk of change over time than just going tenant by tenant.
And I would definitely agree. And I think it is hard to put that tenant in the spot that, hey, tenant, do you want to sort of take on in an adversarial way a person who controls where you get to live at least some level? And I know there are protections, retaliatory evictions, and all those kinds of things that tenants do have protections, but trying to say, okay, I live here only at the pleasure of the law and not because I'm getting along with someone is an uncomfortable thing. And so if there's a way to simply get landlords to start doing this unilaterally, and which I think there is very strongly because the market is there and the data show it, I think you can cover a lot. You reach a tipping point, essentially, where landlords start realizing, I better start doing this, and I'm seeing more ads that say no smoking. Maybe I'll do that too. And I think that's... can cover more ground and get a lot healthier air more quickly by doing that, in my view.
John, I want to thank you for your time, and I really appreciate it. I know an hour and a half on the phone is a big commitment for you, and I really appreciate you taking the time to talk to us today. What we do here in our state is that when we have these calls, we have the recordings put on a website that's available to all the local health departments.
Mm-hmm.
At that point, do you have any problems if I put down your phone number and your email address if anybody has any further questions?
I think that's fine. This is for the local health officials to look at.
Departments, yeah.
Yeah, that's fine. I would encourage if anyone's emailing me to please include their name and phone number, because sometimes emailed questions are easier answered by phone, because I can answer a question in 15 minutes by phone or an hour and a half while I compose the perfect email. So please give me your phone number as well. So.
Right.
Okay.
Thank you, everybody, and thank you, John, again.
But it was
okay,
wonderful.
Well.
Yeah. Thank you, John.
Very good. Good. Bye. Take care. Bye-bye.
Thank you.